EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's American 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Did we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
County dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
Four calls
on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show. How are you all doing? I'm Nick Hunter and this is the UFO Chronicles podcast, first-hand witness accounts of the strange and unexplained. Tonight's guests are Leslie and Stephen Shaw from Southern California, and they will be sharing their UFO and alien encounters, as well as their personal encounters. They took the plunge and co-authored a book. Leslie and Stephen up next.
But first, if you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show.
Leslie, hello Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi Nick, thank you.
Hi Nick.
Thank you both for joining us today and you're calling from California.
Yes.
Sunny Southern California.
Sunny Southern California, wonderful. Now you both have some UFO sightings to share. Would you like to start at the beginning, please?
Well, the first one we shared, which was my first UFO ever, was in 2005 in January. We were driving home from an art club meeting at night on Highway 62 going west, and we saw a bright white light in front of us that just kept getting brighter and brighter, although it looked like it was just hovering. But it must have been traveling towards us because it got larger and brighter, or we to it. And then it took off north over and gone over the northern horizon in less than a quarter of a second. I've never seen anything like that in my life. It moved, had to have been thousands of miles per hour. Right, Steve?
Yeah, as a footnote, we were coming back from Joshua Tree going towards Yucca Valley.
Yes, and it was like, wow, it's real. And I believed my husband. I believed him when he was telling me that he'd had these experiences, but there's something about actually seeing it that just solidifies it in your psyche. And then the second UFO experience I had was 2020, late October, and we just looked up in the sky at our home in Desert Hot Springs and saw a white light in the sky. Again, just a white light, no air, you know, those little red and green lights on either side of an airplane, nothing like that, just a white ball. But it was moving in such a way that it couldn't have been one of our aircraft. It was making sharp turns at speed, and not even just angular turns, like a V turn at full speed, and then shot away again at this ludicrous speed, I call it. like thousands of miles per hour.
I'd like to add on to that, that it was bigger than the first one that we saw. And again, it was silent and it was almost a little bit oblong shaped to me, the way it looked. And it was, again, once again, very silent. And it was, you know, first you're trying to think, well, maybe it's a drone or it's or whatnot. But it was absolutely, to me, that was, for me, that was the most astonishing one that I have seen personally.
Displaying those characteristics that only a UFO can, you know, the hypersonic speeds and angular turns that we can't do. Anytime we turn any one of our aircraft, it has to sort of bank around in a U-turn. It can't turn in a V at speed. And it has to slow down a little, too, to make these turns. So,
let alone the inertia effect on a, you know, physical body and even the machinery in our current technology. It's just impossible.
And that one we saw in 2005, it didn't slowly get up to that speed. It instantaneously went at that speed, which had to have been over 10,000 miles an hour.
Okay, so the first experience I had was when I was about 10 years old in the Woodland Hills area of Southern California, which is fairly close to, let's say, Encino, if people have like an idea of what that is.
It's near Los Angeles.
This is San Fernando Valley. Anyways, the first one I ever saw, it was at nighttime, and it was a large orange orb that was, I'd say, hard to say, maybe 10, 20 miles away, but very large. And it was moving in a direction from south to north. And it was so amazing to me that I saw it was no blinking lights. And I even called Griffith Park Observatory the next day and asked them if they had seen anything. But, you know, hey, we have our telescopes focused towards the heavens. And so now we weren't looking in your direction, you know, per se. The second one that I saw was when I was at the chart house, which is near Malibu. I was coming back from working as an acupuncturist. I was a doctor of acupuncture back in those days, and I stopped for some dinner. And as I was going out and getting in my car, the valet and I, we looked out towards the ocean. This, again, was at nighttime. And this was, I would say, about, oh, man. This must have been about 2005, 2006. And we saw, again, this bright white light that was making wild angular turns and then stopping. And I believe it went into the ocean. We both looked at each other because we were both seeing the same thing at the same time. So that was quite amazing. And then a couple years after that, when I was driving from our home at the time that was in Yucca Valley, California, I was driving down this pass and saw this silver object that was just hovering in the sky. And I happened to be tuned into the radio station 107.7. And Gary Danielle, the host, is saying, hey, are you guys seeing this UFO that's in the sky? So that was a mass sighting. It was not a blimp. It wasn't an airplane. So that was interesting to be involved in a mass sighting. And the other two, Leslie already spoke about. So those are the five that I have seen and she's seen too. Now, as far as my experiences from a family standpoint, my family has, as I grew up as a kid, a lot of this stuff for me was considered to be, okay, we have a family spirit guide. His name is O'Glegley. Supposed to be a tall black man wearing a tunis from Tunisia that we've been seeing off and on for about three generations. My parents grew up in Oldham and Manchester. They grew up as kids during World War II, being born in 1932 and 1933. So they saw a lot of stuff. My grandmother was a spiritualist at one point. They did automatic writing and table levitations and things such as that. And my mom, I remember my mom doing a lot of automatic writing and just writing stuff down that there's no way that she should have had any access to that knowledge. So I grew up knowing that there's a family spirit guide and there was a lot of weird things that would happen. When I was 3 years of age, my first knowledge or memory was waking up on several different occasions in my bed, and there'd be this little creature that would be jumping on my stomach and my chest, just kind of playfully having fun with me.
But it was invisible.
Now, as far as experiences with like the fourth kind, I have one that I haven't had explained to me. This happened to me when I was 18 years of age, still living in Woodland Hills, California. I was working as a cabinet maker with my dad, and my sister was living with us. She was a born-again Christian at the time. Now, I just like to go into detail as a monologue because it might help to put some clarity as far as what was going on in my life. I was beginning to study Tai Chi, and I was working as a cabinet maker. Anyway, this was January of 1979. I had gone to sleep in my work clothes from the day before, and I woke up about 5:30 in the morning. It was pitch black.
It was on the sofa in the living room.
Yes, I was on the sofa in the living room, and I looked at my piano to the right because I'm a pianist and an accordionist. I'm very musically good in that way. And I was thinking about what I was wanting to compose that day, and then I listened to the fountain that was in the other room, and I was awake. I wasn't, you know, in a dream state. And from behind me, from the front door, which is about 30 feet away, this a being of blue-white light, about 6 to 7 feet tall, came through or from the front door upright, and it moved very quickly as if it was floating upright instead of walking. And the whole room behind me was filled with intense blue-white light. When it got to me, in about a second, second and a half, it stopped by my right side. The right side of my body became neutralized, or I call paralyzed. It's basically like taking a knife down from my head down to my toes. The right side of my body, I could not move. Now, it wasn't painful, and I didn't necessarily feel it being ominous. This being a blue-white light bent down towards my right ear and said in a whisper, "Hi, Steve." And I was thinking, being as a kid, I was thinking this was, oh, I'm going to meet the family spirit guide, O'Glegley. And I was full 50-50. I was scared because I couldn't move, but I was excited. And I just stayed there. I couldn't move. And I don't know whether it lasted for 15 seconds or a minute, but it eventually went back the same direction it came, went out the front door. I got up and I told my dad about it, who had also been having strange things happen to him. And we thought about it, had our breakfast, went out to work. Lunchtime comes around. I'm getting hungry. This is about 6 hours later after the event. And I decided to, you know, get some money out of my pocket. So I reached into my right-hand side pocket, pulled out a bunch of coins, and all the coins are magnetized. All the coins are, I could pick up the coins with the coins and things such as that, which are just impossible. U.S. coins are designed not to be magnetic. And my dad and I looked at each other and says, well, you know, what the heck is this? The only mistake I made was I was 18 years of age and I didn't think to get a camera and to record this stuff. But we told my sister, and that was one event. The night before that, I forgot, I was sleeping in my bunk bed and I was awakened by a sound that went whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. And
yeah, a weird whizzing sound.
Right? And I looked down the hallway. My door was open to my room. I looked down the hallway. The kitchen light was on, so I could see down the hallway a little bit, and I couldn't see anything. So I rolled over on my left side to go back to sleep, and then the bed started moving. From the foot of the bed, it felt like somebody had pushed it twice. I thought, well, maybe it's like a mini earthquake like we get, you know, in Southern California. So I decided to try to go back to sleep again, and it pushed a little harder, always as if somebody was pushing with the palms of their hands from the base of the bed. And then it happened a third time, even with more force. And then the fourth time, I got a tap on my right shoulder 3 times, just as if a human being or a being with an index finger would tap you 3 times on the shoulder. And at this point, I was getting really annoyed, and I rolled over really quickly and said, "What?" You know, and again, I couldn't see anything, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything per se. During that same time, my dad was awakened about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he always kept his bedroom door open, as did I. And he awoke and saw this wall of blue-white light outside of my bedroom and going into my bedroom. And he was going to get up, and he heard a voice in his head say, "Go back to sleep, Jeffrey. Everything's fine. You'll be okay. Just go back to sleep." By the way, my Jeffrey is the British spelling of Jeffrey, the G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y. That might be of interest to some people. And the other one, which my sister, my father, and myself all experienced together, happened at 9:30 at night, around the same time period. My dad heard it first. He heard the silver bell being rung inside the wall by our fireplace. And he came into my room and said, "Stephen, am I hearing things? Come in. I want you to listen to this." And I came in, and sure enough, it was in the 2x4 wall. It sounded exactly like a silver bell being rung. And then we got my sister, again, who was a born-again Christian at the time, didn't want to have anything to do with this stuff. She came in, and she heard exactly the same thing. It kept on going on. We banged on the wall and tried to make reasoning or excuses like it's an animal or something like that, but it was absolutely a silver bell. And these are all things that there are many, many other things I can go on about being contacted at different times. And
it's very common in his family. His brother Philip, his younger brother Philip, related several experiences to me, and a lot of this sounds like it's a haunting instead of a alien experience. Except that one time Philip did see a gray alien in his room, and then he blacked out and had a large chunk of missing time afterwards. There's a lot of missing time incidents in Stephen's history as well. Tell him about that time you were walking down the hallway. Yes,
I was about 8 years old, and I was sleeping on the top of the bunk bed at the time. We had just recently gotten a bunk bed. My brother was on the bottom, and I heard noises in the house that didn't sound right. And I got out of the bunk bed and I was walking down the hallway, and I know I was awake because I could feel my heart pounding, and I was really nervous because it was scary because it wasn't my parents and I didn't know what it was. And I got about halfway down the hallway and then I just blank out. And the next thing I remember, a few hours later, I'm back in my bunk bed on top, sleeping. And I have no memory at all of, you know, what was at the bottom of the hallway, what was at the end of the hallway, and my getting back into bed. And I know I wasn't sleepwalking.
And we tried to have him do hypnotic regression to remember what happened walking down that hallway and what happened next. But we haven't been able to break through the block in his psyche.
And I personally believe in angels and protectors, especially because what happened to me when I was 31 years old on April Fool's Day, of all things, when I was swimming in the Pacific Ocean, Nicholas Canyon Beach, I decided to go body surfing, and I foolishly went out too far with a bunch of guys. And, you know, the Pacific Ocean is pretty darn cold. And I got kind of out there, and the guys started coming in. I said, "Well, I better come in too." And I was swimming into a riptide that I didn't realize, and I hadn't been swimming for quite a while. So even though I had been a good swimmer, I wasn't in shape. So I'm swimming and I'm not getting anywhere. And all of a sudden my arms become feeling like they're lead. They're cold. And I just can't move them anymore. And I said, "Oh no, I'm in real trouble." So I spot a lifeguard, one of the lifeguard towers, who's flirting with three girls, and I yelled, you know, once, and I yelled twice, and the third time I yelled as hard as I could and was able to raise one arm above my head, and then I went down. And I knew I was dead because I was at least about 100 feet out, and he was on the beach by the tower. And I started to see the light, you know, the white light, and I start getting this warm feeling coming over myself like, "Oh, this isn't going to be too bad. I'm going to die. There's no way this guy in 2 seconds can make that distance." And sure enough, even with the tide moving, this hand reached down and grabbed me. I was about 6 feet, 5-6 feet under, and grabbed my right arm and pulled me up. He put me in the position where they rescue people, where they put you on your back and put their arm around your neck. And he said, just relax, I got you. And he pulled me back onto the beach, and my arm still could barely move. And my wife at the time was less than sympathetic. And he says, are you okay? But she was not happy that I went body surfing. And I turned to look to thank the lifeguard, and the lifeguard wasn't there. They said, what lifeguard? You know, it was one of these things like, you know, who? So it was quite strange, but I absolutely know from firsthand experience that unusual things do occur, especially those coins being magnetized. I have tried to magnetize coins since that experience. And for me, that's direct evidence, especially manifesting as a blue white being. Now, there's one other experience that I did not put in our book, but it happened when I was 23. And at the time I was studying and practicing Tai Chi Chuan all the time. I taught it for 23 years in addition to that, but I was reading a book on Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi. And this was Christmas, December 26th of 1982. I was sleeping on my back on the floor at that time in my life. So I went to sleep around about 11:30 and woke up about 4:45 in the morning. I know it was 4:45 because I looked at the VCR clock, and I thought my body felt extremely, extremely relaxed, not sleep paralysis, because I was fully awake, but I felt almost like glued to the floor, but awake. And I thought about God's love, and I have no idea why I did, but I just thought about God's love, one single thought. And it was as if my heart and my brain smiled at the same time. I felt this smile come over me, and as if two points came together from my heart to my head, and from what seemed like a billion miles away, in an instant, an inverted pyramid of blue-white light hit me right in my third eye, and my body was encased in this cocoon of blue-white light energy. I was cocooned in this blue-white light, and it was the most incredible feeling of perfection I've ever had in my life. I felt, in an instant, I knew why the yogis sit in their lotus stances for 8 to 10 hours a day with smiles on their faces, because they talk about experiencing the universal love and universal energy. And I just enjoyed it for the time that it lasted. I told my parents about it. And at that point I was thinking, well, maybe I should move to Tibet, or should I help my family, my brother and my sister, get through school? And I chose to help that. Plus I also still had military duty obligations. So I know these things exist. I've had direct experience, and that's why one of the reasons why we wanted to write the book and share what we know as being truth.
And poor Philip, Stephen's brother, he grew up affected by this, in our opinion. He did not grow up a normal human being. He became a hermit-like. He became a miser. And later in life, he seemed to back away from humanity altogether, and almost never left the house. And he built a house out in the forest with a large deck on it. And he was pestered by an orb, this round white orb about 8 inches in diameter, would float up and down his deck. And then one night he went outside and was looking at it, and it rushed him. It rushed towards him and passed through his body at his neckline and went out the back of his body about there. And then I was talking to him the very next day, and he told me about this experience. And I looked on his back, and sure enough, there was a bruise at the top of his back, bottom of his neck, right where the thing had gone through him. And poor Philip was deeply affected by this for his whole life, culminating in a a horror at the end of his life where he shot his mother and his two cats and then himself and ended his life that way. It was quite the tragedy, happened in 2017. And so, unfortunately, Philip can't speak for himself anymore. We have to speak for him.
My brother, when he was young, I'd say probably between the age of 8 and 13, for a good portion of that time, he was so scared of what he called the little men that would show up in our room that he started to sleep in the closet. And so for at least a couple of years, he was sleeping in the closet. And my brother was a brilliant man. He taught calculus for fun at a college level, and he was also a draftsman and an engineer, and he was quite good in that area, quite gifted. And so,
but I would say emotionally, it's like the emotional side of his personality was atrophied or damaged. I don't know how else to put it exactly.
So that's the nuts and bolts of what I think we could share that's pertinent at this point.
Yes, a lot of Stephen and his family all have these missing time experiences. And in our research, we find that is the signature stamp for alien abduction, as big chunks of missing time, where you're wide awake in the evening, and the next thing you know, it's 10 in the morning the next morning.
You know, you often find when people have had these UFO experiences, these alien encounters, you do find very, very often, my guess, where there's paranormal activity, you know, these other things which are going on, which would suggest that they are connected in some way.
Yes, if Philip hadn't seen the gray alien in his room, I don't know if I would have attributed all this to an alien presence. I would have said maybe it's a haunting or something like that, but once he spotted the gray alien in the room, that told us who was doing this, what's going on.
As a side note, my uncle my uncle was married to my mother's older sister, so not direct bloodline at all, but he was in the RAF just after the big war, WW2, and he was stationed in Ceylon at the time. And he was awakened about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning by this tall man, again, looked like a tall black man dressed in a fez. And it told him, it woke my Uncle Douglas up and said, "You need to get out now." And he didn't know what to think, but he'd heard about the family spirit guide, old Glegley. And he did what he was supposed to do. So he got up, got out of his cot, and went to the galley or whatever it was. And a raid came through of some of the force that they were fighting against, and several of the people that were in their cots were killed. And so my Uncle Douglas has had, and he studied things like Uri Geller, and I was very close with my uncle, and he just recently died, but he was, again, he grew up in Great Britain, and very, very, he's very accomplished when it came to things like banking and real estate and things like that. And he was a great, great man, and very, very down to earth, very no nonsense, like the Brits.
Oh, I wanted to tell them too about Stephen broke his shoulder. What year was that?
Oh, that was 2013, September 26th.
Yeah, he had a terrible fall and broke his shoulder and scapula in 7 places, and then went in for an X-ray, of course. And then, sure enough, on the X-ray, we spotted a tiny little, looked like a hunk of a little elliptical piece of metal inside his shoulder. And then the doctor performed the surgery to repair his shoulder. And the X-rays after that show it is gone. So we think that the doctor, I don't know, while he was doing the surgery, pulled it out and said, "What the heck is this?" and tossed it.
the piece of metal, it was oblong, and the radiologist didn't know what to make of it because it was in my deltoid. It was nowhere close to where the fracturing had happened. It was the worst part of my fall, which happened on the 29 Palms military base in 29 Palms, the Marine base, was that I ripped all 4 of my rotator cuffs and dislocated and did some fracturing.
Yeah,
it was
quite the bad fall.
Of the glenoid cavity of the shoulder. But this one single piece that was in an area that had nothing to do with where the fracturing occurred, the radiologists didn't know what to think of it. And at that time, we weren't involved in writing a book.
Right. So. We didn't. And then it was later that we realized that this is probably one of these little tracking devices that they're putting in people.
Yeah. Almost every time that I've been approached by these beings, they always approach me from my right side. And especially when I got tapped three times on my right side when I was, again, I was 18. It's just interesting that it's, you know, as far as my memory is, that it was a very, very short-term experience, but I can't really tell you how long it was, but it's always my right side. And that was interestingly where that metal piece of metal that was about an inch below the skin was seen in the deltoid region by the radiologist.
And Stephen is still experiencing stuff like this. It tends to be in his dreams more, but also in that waking state halfway in between fully awake and asleep. He'll wake up and look around the room and see a being in the room, a dark being with golden eyes, or it seems like it's just not over. It's still going on.
Wherever we move, they follow us. So it's not just the haunting of a certain place or a certain building. This has been following me around, no matter whether I'm in Sonora, California, or Palm Desert, or Palm Springs, or Woodland Hills. This has just been following me.
Yep. And I'll testify to that. And I wonder, have I been taken? I don't think so. But I've read many, many an account where abduction victims are taken out of the bed right next to their sleeping spouse, who never wake up and are never aware of it.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
And Leslie, before you and Stephen got together, how did you feel about the subject beforehand?
I don't know. I had an opinion until I became an adult and started catching the news about it. And when I met Stephen, he was a fan of the Ancient Aliens program, and I started watching that with him. And that's a real eye-opener, that program. You start to realize there's a lot going on behind the scenes that the average human just doesn't know about.
We actually met in 1993, so we've been together for quite a while, way before Ancient Aliens was even a program. But we didn't, you know, I was well into my career, and you know, Leslie was into her career too, so we didn't talk about it too much, but we did talk about it. And at that time, Leslie, you know, didn't really know whether she believed me, of course, because she loves me, but she wasn't, you know, 100% sure until she saw her first, you know, UFO, and also started to have some strange things happen to her too. We took some classes for about 2 years called Gnosis, and we did a lot of specific chanting, different type of chanting techniques that were designed to open up the seven different chakras. And then she started to experience clairaudience, and a lot of these things with the aliens started to come back to me in a very kind of a negative, and saying, oh, don't want to go down this path, kind of menacing. For her, she learned how to astral project and she was having fun. For me, it was very menacing and scary.
Yes, it's like they were just on the other side of the curtain waiting for him. And every time he would astral project, he would be plagued by trouble from beings that were harassing him. And it's in a terrible imposition, really. I mean, it interferes with his spiritual development and his happiness. I call the abduction phenomenon victimized. They're being victimized by this phenomenon. And some people say, well, why do you call it that? And I said, they're kidnapping you. They kidnap you, take you, and then take samples. They're the samples they want from you. This is a terrible violation. And people are psychologically damaged for many, many years. I don't know if Philip would still have killed his mother and himself if this hadn't been happening to him, but I'm sure it didn't help.
And what we found with our research, which I found to be kind of interesting, is correlation between the alien abduction phenomena and vampirism.
Yes. When you think about it, I think this is where the vampire legends come from, because we think that these beings have been victimizing the human race for thousands of years. And but you think about it, the what can the vampire do? He can paralyze you, and he comes for a sample, DNA sample in the form of blood.
He can also change shape. Mm-hmm. He's very powerful and very long lived.
Oh yeah, immortal. And they all always come at night, never during the day.
And their eyes are large, and of course their eyes are the way that they paralyze.
And there's a sexual component too. Vampires are sexy, at least the way we portray them in Hollywood. And the succubus and incubus myths as well, we think these may also be part of it, because one of the things we know about the abduction phenomenon is they're this strange breeding program that they're doing. They're taking fetuses. First, they impregnate the woman with some hybrid creature. Then 4 months later, they take the fetus.
We also find it very interesting about the phenomena of cow mutilations. They also exsanguinate the cow. They take all of the blood, and they take only certain organs and certain parts of the body.
And the sky-facing eye.
And it's always, always the sky-facing eye and the genitals and reproductive tissue.
And the tongue.
We talk about it in our book. We think mm-hmm. it's a necessity. They're doing it not for research and development. It's for a specific need.
That's one thing we discovered in our research, is that the UFO theories were not lining up with what little facts we had. The theory say that, oh, the aliens are abducting us because they're curious about us. It's just scientific curiosity. But when you look at the actual phenomenon, that isn't what's happening. They're not taking samples from a bunch of different people. They frequently take the same person again and again and again through their lives. And then they'll start taking their children and their grandchildren. It's like they find a particular strain of DNA that interests them, and they keep taking it again and again and again. The analogy I make in the book is that it's like a cow, a farmer's cow out in the field. He takes it into the barn, removes the milk, and then puts it back out into the field to generate more milk. And I think that is what's going on with the alien abduction phenomenon. They want this material. They need genetic material. And also, the phenomenon, the abduction phenomenon, is 95% Caucasian. They're particularly interested in Caucasian DNA. Again, and we only make up 18% of the population. So what's this particular interest in specifically Caucasian DNA? And they take a smattering of everybody else, and maybe that is the scientific curiosity. But this taking of Caucasians again and again and again through their whole lives, to me, it sounds more like they're harvesting a product. I was going to ask Nick, in our research, it seems like families with psychic abilities are also targeted more. Have you found that to be the case in your research?
It is something that is very common. Going over all the guests I've had on this show and all the people I've worked with over the years, it's a very wide spectrum. I have people which have very positive experiences. They enjoy it. They welcome it. They want to make this connection. And then at the very end of that spectrum, I've got people which have very traumatic experiences, very difficult, troublesome, which can have a very deep emotional impact on the individual.
I can only imagine. It must be terribly scarring.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you often do find that people have these experiences. They do have this in their family history. You know, they do have occasions of psychic ability or some kind of spiritual connection.
It's definitely the case in Stephen's family, right, honey? The automatic writing and...
Well, yes. Just 2 months ago, I was decided I want to try and confront these beings. So I practice a technique when you're in a dream. I dream every night, and my dreams are very, very vivid. They have, you know, all the touch, the sense, the audio, the talking, and whatever, interacting with different beings. And I go to different places. And if I'm doing something, if I'm alert enough in my dream, I will force myself to look at my palms of my hand. I'll say, this is a dream. And so what I'll do, I will, or I'm astral projecting, I'll look at my palms, and then I can make the dream disappear. Just 2 months ago, I did that, and I was back in my room where I sleep. And there was this being there once again, this one tall and kind of heavy set with the golden eyes. And I said, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? And it grabbed my arm and it kind of pushed on me, and I couldn't get an answer out of it. But I did confront it as of a couple of months ago. And I've had other things happen too, where that one that happened, that again, I was like 23 or 24. And this was, remember that little triangular being, Leslie, I told you about?
Yes, this is the strangest thing.
I was still in the military and I liked sleeping on the floor. I was, you know, very good shape and very skinny, and I just liked sleeping on the floor. And I woke up about 5-6 o'clock in the morning, and the light was on in the room, a little light. And I looked to my right, and up by the ceiling beam was this little triangular headed being, about maybe a foot and a half in height, kind of squarish, and it was kind of shimmery. And it noticed that I noticed it, and it floated down to my right side, and it said to me in a very deep baritone voice, he said, do you want me to help you get out of your body? And I looked at it, and I knew intuitively that I couldn't show any fear. So I felt this little tingling of anxiety in my below my belly, and I said to it, you can help me, but you cannot possess me. And again, I don't know, it was just instinctual. And it grabbed my arm, and it started to go back up into the air, and it kind of let out this scream, like a scream of frustration. And then it left. And then I got up after that, and my dad said, no, who were you talking to? You know?
The triangular-headed being.
The triangular-headed being. It was, again, it's like I say, my mom told me about things that have happened to her that were similar to that. And like I say, I just really didn't think that much of it, you know, especially growing up. So
Interesting. I mean, on here, we have all different accounts, all different experiences.
I'll bet.
UFOs of all shapes and sizes. And I have a lot of accounts on here which are very peculiar. Very peculiar, to say the least. It's important for people to, you know, when they share their experiences, no matter how strange and, excuse the pun, alien it feels to them, you know, it's important to share these accounts because it's a very difficult subject. You know, it can be a very confusing subject. There's so many different angles to it, so many different pieces which are all intertwined.
Yeah, sometimes this is a 1.5 foot tall little being, and then, but the blue-white being is 7 feet tall, and it, And sometimes you see them as gray aliens. Sometimes they're these blue-white light beings. Is this all something that... we know that they twist the memories of the people they abduct. And I think that's what's going on with Stephen. He doesn't remember being on a cold slab with a bunch of aliens around him. But I think if he ever were able to regress and break through that mental block that they've placed in him, that's exactly what he would see.
Oh, I neglected to mention another one that happened to me. I was 31. I was an acupuncturist at the time with my ex-wife, and she's one of these type of people that have to get up at 5:30 in the morning to get herself ready to go to school as a school teacher. And I was still in bed, and we had we're on the second story of a condo, and I was going back to sleep, and I heard the exact sound of somebody starting up a Harley Davidson. And the court that was just outside of our window, down by the court by the pool, was all cement, and this was an enclosed, typical enclosed condominium complex. And I said to myself, who the heck at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning is revving up a Harley Davidson? And I got out of bed to look through the window, and the sound stopped, and there was nothing there. So I went back to bed, was going back to sleep, and it started up again, the same sound of a Harley Davidson. And I was definitely awake because I was going to get out of bed. And then, it sounds crazy, but then all these weird-looking beings came into the room. All different, I can't even, some of them were clown-shaped looking, some were just animals, and they were like pressing on me, and they were like dancing around. And I thought, oh my God, I'm being attacked, or I'm going insane. And my wife was in the kitchen, and she was completely unaware of this. And in other words, it wasn't sleep paralysis, or, you know, people say, oh, it's just sleep paralysis. to me, it was almost like the veil between my conscious and subconscious mind got pulled open. The curtain got pulled open, and a lot of the visions, whatever, that may be in my subconscious came forward. Or there literally was a being in the room, but the sound of the Harley Davidson was extremely distinct. You can't mistake what a Harley Davidson sounds like. And I got out of bed and I was completely awake. So again, it wasn't a dream. It wasn't sleep paralysis.
What happened after they came in?
Well, I was physically drained, and I kind of told Gail about it, but she was getting ready and she just for school, and she just, you know, didn't want to hear about it. But yeah, I was literally shaken for the next few days. And I went to go see afterwards, I went to go see a psychic to talk about it. And she really wasn't very much help, but I was legitimately worried because I was actually afraid to go to sleep for the next, you know, few days, because it was emotionally and physically draining, quite frankly.
And these experiences are so isolating, as far as there's no help. No, there's no one we can go to for help.
We have tried.
Yeah, how can you help us stop this, or, you know, break through the barrier?
I would rather just sit down and talk to these guys and say, hey, what do you want from me? You know, can I help? Just, you know, don't scare me all the time. I've had trouble sleeping now for 20 years. I'm lucky I get 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night for at least 20 years. And that's not healthy for anybody.
This bizarre dream landscape he wakes from. And I don't dream. I have fibromyalgia, and we don't frequently dream. So every morning we wake up and he relates these incredibly bizarre dreams to me. And I can only assume that it has something to do with this phenomenon, that his dreams are so strange.
And my dreams are extremely vivid, and frequently I'll go back to the same place and sometimes meet the same people. And if I were to just sit down and relate my dreams, that would be a whole show in and of itself. But my dreams are, I tell other people about them, and they just think, like, they look at me and says, that's no way. It's no way that you did that or saw that. It's just, you know, I'm a very creative person myself. I'm a musician, and I was like a, you know, practitioner of Chinese medicine for 20 years, state licensed here in California, and taught Tai Chi for 23 years. And, you know, I've worn, you know, military hats, and I've worn the white collar hats. So I've seen things and done different things. And it's still an unanswered question for me.
In the theories that we developed doing our research, we started our research when I saw my first UFO, and we actually began researching the phenomenon. So I guess about 18 years ago, we say 20, but it really, I guess, was about 18. And we started researching the phenomenon more and more. And what I'm discovering in my research, in our research, is that these UFOs, they're moving in our airspace because I think it's because they live here. I don't think they're coming from a different star system. I think, you know, I heard just account after account after account of they come up out of the ocean. They come up out of lakes. They come out of mountains. They come out of volcanoes. They come out of a window all open on the side of a mesa, and UFOs will fly in and out of it. It seems to me that they are here in our airspace, traveling horizontally, and frequently UFOs are seen just traveling horizontally in our airspace, like they're going from one place of our planet to another place on our planet.
And also to the indigenous Indians, such as the Hopi and the Paiute and the Navajos, they call the aliens, quote unquote aliens, call them their star brothers frequently. And they say, oh yeah, we've been seeing these for thousands of years. There's even stories about how they call them the ant people, or the Anasazi, led a group of Indians underground to help them to survive a cataclysm. So,
and then we, you know, the research extended into the experiences of Philip Schneider at the Dulce Air Force Base, the underground base, supposed to be a part alien, part military base. The Dulce papers also came out of that region, showing basically that they're here and that our government is cooperating with them. in league with them.
It's very difficult in that respect. When it comes to a lot of these encounters, it would seem that it's not being orchestrated by an outside force. It definitely does look like there is certainly cooperation in one form. And I don't believe every single account I hear are always alien abductions. I do think that there is definitely cause to believe that some of these experiences are deliberately done.
Yes, that's what our research is showing. Basically, from the Project Blue Book days, it looks like they made some sort of a deal with them that, okay, go ahead, you can take the abduction victims you need as long as you keep feeding us your technology and in dribs and drabs.
There is quite a funny movie called Sneakers. I don't know if you may have seen it or not, with Robert Redford and Dan Aykroyd. But Dan Aykroyd plays the one that believes like every conspiracy theory out there. And they're sitting around the table and he says, so Ike says to the aliens that, hey, take all the cow lips you want, just give us your technology. And I always found that to be kind of funny, is because there were accounts where Ike went down to Palm Springs and there was definitely a chunk of time that was missing from when he came down to Palm Springs in the 50s.
And right. He was supposed to be having some medical procedure, which there was no evidence of later in his life.
And there's, of course, the famous accounts of the UFOs.
And he was supposed to have gone to Air Force, Edwards Air Force Base.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And they're the famous accounts in the newspapers at the time of 2 weekends in a row where UFOs were just hovering over the Capitol during the time of Ike.
Yes, and 1952. It's like they were definitely trying to get our attention. And it was right after that it stopped. So we think that they got their attention, they made contact and met.
And you look at the leaps and bounds we've made since World War II, as far as how quickly technology has progressed and how far we've come in such a short period of time. And yeah, sure, we gained some technology from the Germans. And then we got the Operation Paperclip, where we took the majority of their good scientists like von Braun and a few others. And sure, there's that too. But we have come a long way in a short period of time.
Supposedly the microchip is some of the reverse engineering that was done in the private sector. That was another thing they did. They approached the private sector to reverse engineer some of this alien technology, because the private sector doesn't have to report. It doesn't have the obligation to report.
That's all from General Corser, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That the microchip and I think the Teflon and
Velcro.
Oh, I've got one that would be fairly interesting for you, Nick. I went to one of the seminars that Linda Moulton Howe did for us at Contact in the Desert. And from some of the few pieces of the outside of the alien spacecraft that they've actually been able to recover, that they've actually done electron microscope examinations of, and this stuff cannot be made by humans. It's amazing. The outer shield is between 200 and 400 microns, which is about the thickness of a human hair, if you're lucky. And it's made out of pure zinc and magnesium. The second layer is bismuth, pure bismuth, about 2 to 4 microns, which is much thinner than a human hair, pure bismuth. Then the inner layer is made out of pure aluminum with little nano dots of iridium, which only comes from asteroids. And they have samples of this, and it looks like plywood. But plywood that is
like
bent,
layers, right?
But layered. It's just something that we don't even have with our technology. We can't even touch that, especially getting pure aluminum and pure bismuth and things such as that, and iridium. So we're coming closer and closer to saying, yes, these things do exist, and they're beyond our technology. And this was disclosed just at Contact in the Desert on, I think it was June 3rd of this year.
That's certainly there. 2017. Public opinion has definitely changed somewhat. There's a lot of people which have now found interest in the subject when they didn't really before.
Yeah, the 2017 event that I think has really made an enormous change is the release of the 3 videos on the story to the New York Times by Luis Elizondo, the head of ATIP. The GoFast, the Gimbal, and the Tic Tac videos, very compelling, and are everywhere on YouTube, so anybody can see them anytime they want. And it was right after that that the DOD, the Department of Defense, you know, for 80 years, they just stonewalled us, ufologists. It was, there is, this is not happening. It's swamp gas. It's not real. It's mass hysteria. It's anything except what it is. And then in 2017, Luis Elizondo releases those videos, and then the DOD, to our astonishment, confirmed that they were real. This is really happening, they're saying now. After 80 years of stonewalling us, they're finally coming clean in that one way. They're still saying that they don't know what it is, which of course is a lie, since they have crashed spaceships and dead aliens and possibly some live ones in their possession. We know that they're still lying to us, but the change in the policy of being willing to admit this is real is an enormous difference.
And also changing the name to, they conveniently changed, now they call them UAPs. And
right.
Of course, you know, so that's another thing too, to kind of change the subject. And it's, in fact, the Congress over here in this country, just about a month ago, they had hearings on the UFO and the UAP phenomena. And of course, the Department of Defense still wasn't forthcoming with any information, but you know, the congressmen and people are starting to get a lot more open about saying, you know, we want to know. And the president doesn't have high enough clearance to get information. President Clinton tried and tried, said, listen, I've tried, but apparently I don't have the high enough clearance. And it's true. The president doesn't have high enough clearance, so he can't get the answers either.
A new package now. Like I said, people which weren't interested in the subject beforehand are now, mostly because they have governmental people telling them, you know, this is definitely real. But why the turnaround all of a sudden?
I think it's because everyone has a video camera in their pocket now. It's harder to hide when there's a camera on every hip.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I wouldn't 100% put faith in everything that comes out. A lot of time you'll find that when things are put in a press conference and they're told, they're not always 100% accurate, and it makes you wonder the reasons behind it. Whenever anyone comes out, you know, I'm always a little bit cynical, especially if it's from that side.
Yeah, I grew up in a very no-nonsense family from wartime England, and, you know, always taking things, you know, with a grain of salt and just, okay, if it happens to me and I have direct experience, then I have more trust in it. But hearing somebody tell me some stories I've heard from people, I can just say, oh, well, this goes dong to me instead of ding.
In our book, we concentrated on, well, the first chapter of our book is, it's a kind of a crash course on UFO activity in the USA over the last 80 years. Because if we wanted to discuss our UFO theories with people, we had to make sure they had at least a basic knowledge of what's been going on. So that was the start of the book. But we concentrated on mass sightings. You know, when it's one person, maybe it's a lie, or maybe they're crazy or whatever, or they're misunderstanding what they're seeing. But if 300 people call into the police saying there's a UFO just flew through their backyard, then we're pretty sure it's a real phenomenon.
I like to call it, like, referring back to Nick, what you said earlier about not believing everything that comes out, you know, especially with the government. Is it a truth sandwich or is it a lie sandwich? Is it a lie hidden between two slices of truth, or a truth hidden between two slices of a lie? You know, so what type of a sandwich are they feeding us? You know, so
I'm not saying people, you know, shouldn't get excited, you know, about everything that's been going on over the last few years, talking on the government side, but always have a little bit of caution, because this is coming from agencies and governments which have lied. They have lied for decades.
Yep, through their teeth, bold face, to our faces.
Exactly. So
yep.
You've got to kind of absorb all the information and then decide that way.
But since that 2017 release of those videos by Elizondo, there's been two more reports issued by the DOD, and I've read them, and they're actually admitting to people getting radiation burns from being too close to the UFOs. They're admitting that weird pregnancies are occurring from the abduction phenomenon. They're literally admitting some of the craziest stuff right in these reports, and so few people are reading them that nobody knows about it, except us in the little ufology community.
You know, they've said, we don't investigate this. We haven't done it in the past. You know, we have no interest. But, you know, the truth is they've always had an interest.
Yes, they have.
But, you know, say back in the 90s, for instance, I used to give lectures and I would find that there'd be people in the audience, which, you know, they didn't belong there. They weren't the usual crowd that you get that would come to the meetings and the talks and stuff.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you could probably talk to 100 different other researchers if they've had contact with, say, agencies.
We use Men in Black here.
Men in Black. There's been several occasions of my guests that we've had that, but there's always been an interest.
Telepath is a weekly digital newsletter filled with the latest paranormal news, trending topics, and fresh articles from some of the most popular critical thinkers in the community today. Stay informed on your favorite paranormal podcasts and live streaming talk shows. Interact with the Telepath and upload your paranormal story or pics. It could be featured in an upcoming edition. Sign up right now for the free Telepath newsletter at paranormal.radio. That's paranormal.radio.
In our research, we kept seeing reports about, you know, there'd be a mass sighting in a town in middle America somewhere. These men in black would show up and they would, without any identification, they would grill every single witness, making sure they had all of the pertinent data for themselves. And then they would start their campaign. They start with ridicule. They start by ridiculing the witnesses to make them feel stupid and laugh at them. They would laugh at them. And if that didn't work, they would threaten them, threaten their families if they didn't keep quiet. And if that didn't work, they would retaliate in ways like they would get you fired or some other pressure of some kind. And then we think in the fourth case, they would just kill people, silence you that way. And this was government. We believe it was government policy. We have this, you know about that, the Project Blue Book manual that was leaked to a journalist a long time ago, I forget what year, showing that this was their plan. Show up, get the information, all the pertinent data for themselves, and then step-by-step ridicule, harassment, just a blueprint for how to handle UFO sightings in a small town.
What really surprises me, Nick, especially when you hear about the stories of the men in black showing up on Navy ships, like battleships, and like an event had just happened, witnessed by many, many sailors, and had taken pictures and whatever and written stuff down. These guys just show up just within a day. And they'll talk to the captain. The captain turns over all responsibility to these guys, and then they go, and they take all the film, all the documentation, and frequently have people sign non-disclosure agreements sometimes. But it's amazing the response time. It's as if there's like a monitoring that goes on all the time, or the UFO itself says, "These guys saw us. You need to respond." But there's this interaction that I just find fascinating, how quickly they respond to anything that has been seen, especially by multiple people.
So they care a great deal, and they cared a great deal, but then they would have to laugh the incident off. So this ridicule program, that's the reason that people laugh about it today. They're still influenced by it, turning the whole phenomenon into some big joke. When it's nothing but, it's deadly serious.
And also, of course, you know, you look at, you know, 1938 with War of the Worlds, with that whole program that showed just how xenophobic, especially Americans are. I mean, people actually tuned in a little bit late to the show, and they believed that some people killed themselves. They certainly reacted in a very xenophobic manner. So
that may have given them a clue that we just can't handle this kind of information.
You just look at what would happen to the world economies if all of a sudden we announced that, hey, these people have been living underneath our floorboards for X amount of thousands of years and they're more technologically advanced. It would certainly upset the stock markets and the flow of money and goods, and it would cause chaos. So I think there are reasons, the other just basic financial reasons why they're still saying, oh no, there's something going on, but oh golly gee, we don't know what they are or who they are, but they don't seem to be a threat, but yeah, something's going on. But yeah, certainly I think a lot of it is too financial.
Yes, I call it the gosh gee, we admit these things are real, but we don't know what they are policy.
Indeed, I was actually thinking about that the Orson Welles program the other day, and you know, if that came out today, would people react the same? I like to believe that people would be interested and wouldn't act in a crazy way if all this information was just dumped out to us.
I think we've been sort of, maybe desensitized is the right word, by movies, you know, about aliens and shows about aliens. I think it would be quite a different reaction now that people would have.
It's a difficult one. I mean, the last few years, you know, people have been doing some, you know, some pretty crazy stuff. You know, I'm not too sure. A lot of this information has come out now and people have been very blasé about it. For what reason, I'm not sure. Even though the governments have come out and said this, it's not the talk of the town. It is obviously within the community and people which have been pulled across of interest to it. But you'd think it'd be everywhere for everyone to be talking about it, but they simply are not. And I think because there's so much stuff going on in the world at the minute, it's kind of, everything is overshadowing the subject.
And I think I went to hearkening back to Linda Moulton Howe, her hour and a half talk on disclosure. And Leslie has it right from the standpoint that I think things are being leaked for the sake of humanity. You know, we all want to think, especially Leslie and I being big Star Trek fans, that you know, that in the future we're part of the Federation and we've gotten away from money being important and self-development and, you know, meeting new races.
And we're traveling the galaxy.
Now, one of the things that was disclosed by Linda Moulton Howe, she said she met this guy. They went on this boat so they couldn't be heard and they talked for 7 hours. And he was saying he's leaking his information that we as America have been involved since 2003, and we are actively flying around to 26 different solar systems with the tall white aliens and the Nordics, who are our friends. And two of these spaceships happen to be named after two of the guys who run on the original Majestic 12. And we're in league with these people, and we've gone to the planets Piscean and Rigel 4, and Rigel 4 is inhabited by the Reptiloids. And she's saying this with a straight face to about 500 or 600 people and showing these little graphs of where Piscean is, how many light years away it is. And really, so they're feline beings, they're reptiloids, they're insectoids, they're humanoids. And some of them like us, some of them don't. But mixed in with that, was she was showing that piece of those two pieces of metal that were obviously not man-made. So there's this BS, I call it, mixed in with the truth, which is this metal that we can't make. And just some guy comes forward and talks to you, Linda, for 7 hours and saying that, oh yeah, we already are on Starship since 2003. To me, that stretches credulity, you know, to the breaking point.
The way I see it is it's a what we want to hear-isms.
Yes.
This is exactly what we want to hear, that we're part of a Federation, that we're already traveling the galaxy. Nobody would love it to be true more than Stephen and I. But we don't think that's what's happening. We think that these creatures reside here on the planet underground and are playing space aliens. They want us to looking up for answers instead of down where the answers really are. In my opinion, that's what's going on. Do you remember the incident with the Valiant Thor, Nick?
I do indeed. Yeah, the Pentagon.
Yes, the alien at the Pentagon.
Stranger at the Pentagon, that's it.
Yeah, the Stranger at the Pentagon, that's right. He lands in a spaceship in a field in Virginia and wants to be taken to the president, or ends up getting taken to the Pentagon, and supposedly resided with us for 3 years. And supposedly, he said he came from Venus. And it looked just like a Caucasian, red-haired Caucasian man, and claimed to have come from Venus. Well, now we know that you can't come from Venus. Nothing is alive on Venus, probably. So That's a lie. He lied to us. So why would he lie to us? One of the reasons we think is that because they are here already. They live under our feet in underground bases. That's why you keep hearing that's where the UFOs are coming from. They're coming out of lakes, out of mountains, out of the ocean. They're not coming from far above and down.
And it also explains their interest in our military bases and how they have the ability to turn off our nukes whenever they want to. This is all documented.
Yes. You know. I think the nuclear, you know, the U.S.'s use of nuclear bombs on Japan, I think that frightened them. I think they didn't want us messing with nuclear power. And so they started, UFOs started showing up at all of our nuclear bases. And actually, in the Malmstrom incident, they shut down all our, the 10 warheads were taken offline.
The ICBMs were taken offline.
Yeah, the 10 ICBMs were taken offline, one after another after another. And these are all separate systems. And of course, this UFO is flying over, hovering over the base.
Same kind of things have been reported in Great Britain, too.
So if they were a distant star system, coming from a distant star system, and we were on the verge of destroying ourselves with nuclear weapons, they might care enough to worry for us. But the reaction they had was like more like they were worried about themselves. I think that they were terrified by our use of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think they probably look at us like children with matches.
So when I was a doctor, I used to use this analogy about the human brain, where we have this fantastic device that's been developed through probably nature and probably a little bit of help. And it's like we're given this Ferrari that has 1,000 horsepower engine, and we aren't given an instruction manual except to show how you can turn it on and how you can accelerate. And we're going down through life on this one lane road that is barely lit with this Ferrari that has 1,000 horsepower. And we don't know if there's going to be a turn coming up or not. We just have this fantastic computer in our heads that we barely use. And all we know how to do is basically, you know, accelerate and turn it on and maybe turn on the headlights. And as for that, anything else is basically just either luck or just guess. You know, we just don't really know. The more and more we learn about the human brain is, you know, even the neocortex, you know, some of the scientists are saying that one very small part of the human neocortex that about 300,000 years ago was all of a sudden we gained the ability to speak. Jason Martell was talking about that. And when they do dissections, it looks like that part of the neocortex, it was a patch job, where that part that gives us the ability to speak was actually added in on the chromosomal DNA level. So it's interesting to see that, you know, finally we're starting to catch up through science to be able to even prove some of these achievements. I mean, we didn't have the ability to speak up until a relatively short period of time ago.
About 50,000 years.
Yeah, so it certainly makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Indeed.
And Leslie Stephen, you also briefly mentioned your book earlier. Can you tell us what it's called, please?
It's Who They Are and What They're Up To. We try to answer the big questions in the book. So many UFO books, and believe me, we've read a pile of them, talk about the phenomenon in general, or sometimes a specific incident they'll go into in great detail. But we're looking at the subject as a whole, trying to look at it, the umbrella over it, and explain who are flying these machines, what they want from us, why they're here, where they come from, etc. Trying to answer, like I say, as we were doing our research, I kept seeing interviews with people, and they'd be terrified, lost, no idea what they saw, grasping for any explanation as to what they're seeing. And we had theories. And so I thought, let's impart our theories. Maybe it'll help these people.
So we also tied that in with ancient history and what has been seen and documented through the thousands and thousands of years. And it was basically a learning experience for us, but also would help to explain. And also we're basically giving people answers and whys, who, what, why, how, in the book, instead of just a dry just explanation, this event happened. We trying to find the answers for people that it's, in other words, we are looking for the horses and not the zebras. We see a lot of people chasing zebras these days. Like now it's very popular where people talk about interdimensionals from the fourth and fifth dimension. And
it's time travel. These are creatures from the future.
Einstein, Rosenbridges, wormholes, and, you know, just, you know, zebra type stuff. But, you know, we're basically more no nonsense. Just be, you know, if it's, you know, look for the horse if you hear hoofbeats. Unless if you're in certain parts of Kenya, then you might actually be hoofbeats. They might be zebras.
We've seen their evidence of their habitation on this planet for thousands of years. So again, it points more to a species that is here living with us rather than something that's traveling here from vast distances. That was another thing that didn't add up, right? Oh, they're supposed to be coming here from another star system. How come we're seeing them 10,000 times a year? There's 10,000 reported sightings per year, every year, for 100 years that we've been tracking it, and probably thousands of years before that. So we see them definitely as cohabitants of this world.
So our book strives to give people answers to what looks to be the most reasonable explanation for what's going on. And I call it necessity. They're out of necessity. The need is because of necessity.
And so many of these creatures, these beings, they're humanoid. Almost all of them are humanoid. And I see them as much closer relatives to us than aliens. For instance, our closest relative on the planet is a variety of chimpanzee. If you look at the human next to the chimpanzee, we look nothing alike. And this is our absolute closest relative on the planet. But you look at a gray alien, we have a lot more in common with them than we do with the chimpanzee. They walk upright. Their proportions are the same as ours. Their eyes are in the right place. The nose is in the right place. The mouth is in the right place. The ear holes are in the right place. The elbows bend the correct way. The knees bend the correct way. The pelvis is the same shape as ours. They're the only other creature that we know of that walks perfectly upright like we do, except, you know, possibly Bigfoot and us. And that's it. And I think we have a lot more in common with these creatures than we do with the chimpanzee.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah, I agree with you there. Wonderful stuff. Who They Are and What They're Up To by Leslie and Stephen Shaw.
It's available on Amazon and Ingram.
Perfect. What I'll do is I'll leave links in the description of this episode and on our website.
Super. Thank you so much.
Good stuff. Okay. Leslie, Stephen, I really appreciate you both coming on and sharing that for our listeners.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It was my pleasure. It was lovely having you on, okay? Keep in contact and I will talk to you soon.
Ta-ta.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now. That's all for this week. Keep updated and connected with the show on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you'd like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Or you can reach out to me via the contact page on my website at ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to Leslie and Stephen for sharing tonight, and thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.